Blog Talk Radio.
Come to you each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our regular hosts are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Chuck Albright, Howard Mucci, Jim Grayville, George Jen, Neil Holland, and me, Jim Hart. Our hosts, if you have followed our shows, are scattered from South Florida, Central Florida, North Florida, North Carolina, Kentucky, New York, and where I am right now, living on the beautiful island of Martha's Vineyard. Now, to be with us with your comments, remember to call in and to our show using our phone number, 213-816-1611. Be sure that you press number 1 on your telephone keypad to connect with us. Otherwise, you'll just be listening in to the show over your telephone. It's easier to just listen by going to our website, www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. That's CaptainEddie. Neil, will you tell us what's going on with tonight's show, please?
Yes, Jim, I'll be happy to. Folks, tonight we will tell some of the great stories that have appeared in the Retired Eastern Pilot Association's official magazine called Repartee. It's interesting how the magazine came about with that name. It started simply as newsletter, but quickly changed over to a more appropriate banner when a retired pilot recognized that most of the content described the word repartee. As defined by Webster, it's a witty reply, a succession of clever replies, or skill in making such replies. All were apropos to much of the magazine's over 35 years of publishing content. These stories tell much of Eastern's history. We have selected 4 from the past and hope you enjoy them. If you would like to comment about any of these stories, please remember you can call us, just as Jim said, area code 213-816-1611, and we would love to hear from you. Chuck, would you tell us the first of these great memories by former Eastern employees?
Well, thank you, Neil. Since I was in Eastern maintenance, I can relate to this story as told by Captain Marlowe. It's the title, Eastern's Wright Cyclone. Most of us remember the unforgettable sound and the feeling of this remarkable, gutsy little engine known as the Wright Cyclone. It never failed us during our early passenger carrying days. In the Navy during World War II, we seemed to have little success with Wright engines. The rocker box covers warped and leaked. Oil seemed to cover our aircraft. The engine props locked or went into low pitch. Something was always breaking. It could have been due to the way we operated them or to our maintenance. all of us were just a bunch of kids. It seemed inconceivable that Eastern Airlines would be using these engines when everyone else utilized the Navy's favorite, the Pratt Whitney Wasp. Our engines seemed rough by comparison. They didn't have that old zingy acceleration lacking in the others, but once seemed like rough, becoming a source of confidence, for you knew the engine was doing its job. Actually, Eastern's Wright Cyclone was built like a tank. But the real success of this engine was due to the enterprising effort of Johnny Ray's maintenance department and the people such as Bish Simpson in Atlanta. Bish recalls, "The engine was so rugged, it seemed as though it had been built in a blacksmith shop. It was our engineering department that made the Wright engine famous. Eastern had a deal with Curtis Wright, where Eastern had privileges to make modifications on the engine. Curtis Wright gave Eastern credit for the engine success. Pratt & Whitney made a very precise engine. It was more expensive and had less horsepower. The Wright was heavier and more rugged. Later, Wright increased the horsepower by changing parts, and this resulted in less success with the engine. Eastern, however, seemed to have hit on a perfect combination of horsepower and weight. Johnny Ray's maintenance department developed special tools to maintain the engine in the shop. As an example, Tony Pizzicato developed a locking device for holding the cylinder nuts down so tight that they wouldn't shake loose. All the nuts could be locked down at one time with this special tool. Bish Simpson invented the snake catcher. Valves would stick as a result of the carbon buildup from high-octane fuel. Ordinarily, it would require removal of the cylinder from the engine. But with a snake catcher, you could reach down through the spark plug hole and snare the valve stem, as you would catch a snake, and put it back into the valve guide without having to take the cylinder off. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker gave Bush Simpson a citation for this, and the snake catcher became a tool with Curtis Wright used. Eastern Airlines was a company composed of entrepreneurs all working together. There were never anything quite like it. Our Wright Cyclone and aircraft number 344 that occupies a post of honor in the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. Captain Gene Ramsey flew it in there on his final flight. Well, to take a picture of something hanging from the ceiling, four stories high, with the nearest access, a balcony some 100 feet away, you call our affiliate member of REPA, Frank Spur. To really appreciate this beautiful engine, one needs to look at the high polish on the props, the cylinder fins, the pushrod housing, the ignition harness, and the shiny paint on the housing. All of these were naturally shaded by the cowling. That is why Frank Spur took some great photos of this engine at night. Folks at the Smithsonian, who were most cooperative, scheduled Frank to take these photographs when our honorary REPA member, Dr. Paul Graver, was going to hang the Wright flyer. Frank used multiple flashes with both cross-lighting and direct fill. We're all grateful for Frank for his dramatic pictures that appeared in Repartee. No one could shoot it like Frank Spur.
Oh, wow. Thank very much, Chuck. Let me tell you, I can remember those days because I had some, really inkling of mechanical things. And when I saw what was going on, I thought it was just so beautiful. Listen, do any of our hosts at this point have any comment on Chuck's article?
Yes, yes. Jim.
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm sorry, Neil. Maybe some of our listeners may not know which airplane that we are talking about, the Wright Cyclone, was on, and it was on, of course, the DC-3. And can any of you name another airline that whose DC-3s had the Wright Cyclone engine on it?
Gee, I want to say. Yeah, I want to say Southern. I'm not certain about that, Steve.
No, that's not correct. It happened. Capital Airways.
Oh, Capital. Okay.
Capital used the Wright Cyclone while I was working for Piedmont then, and we had the old smooth Pratt & Whitney.
Pratt & Whitney, yeah. But My comment was that, well, I was going to ask the host, have you been to the Smithsonian and seen that beautiful DC-3 that Gene Ramsay flew in? You know, when they flew the airplane in, they had to take the wings off and they rolled it down all the streets going over and crossing the bridges, I guess the 14th Street Bridge and so forth, to bring it to the Smithsonian, where it now is enshrined. But what a feeling it is to look at that airplane. It's a great feeling.
Just to answer your question, I have. I've been there. And my father, who worked for Eastern from 37 to 52, I took pictures of that airplane to him, and he said that he remembered that plane coming into Charleston, South Carolina.
He remembers
of the airplanes that came through his station up there.
Uh-huh.
One of the other things I like to make a comment on is I was very fortunate in my career to meet Johnny Ray. It was just a happening at Eastern Airlines employee cafeteria, and I was sitting there by myself and eating and trying to get back to work because we only had like so much time. And the gentleman said, "May I sit down at the table with you?" And I said, "Sure, sit down." And I looked up and I recognized who he was because he had been in the Eastern paper quite a few times. So I knew who he was, and I said, "Sure, I'd be glad to have you, Mr. Ray." And we sat and talked about what was going on in the daily operations of maintenance because he seemed to get around to all the departments, even at the age, he must have been in his 80s at that time. And I asked him some questions about the old times. He didn't actually bring up the Wright cyclone, but he did bring up the idea that it was really touch and go there when they first started out because they had very few mechanics to work on Eastern's airplanes, and they, of course, were trying to make schedules and everything else. But he was a very interesting man, a very quiet person. I thought he was just super just to sit there and talk with.
Well, Chuck, let me also add that from what I have read of the history of Eastern, that he was one of the closest individuals or people with Eastern to Eddie Rickenbacker. Mm-hmm. He was one of Eddie's closest friends. So I've heard that and read some of the stories that they were very, very close. Any other comments before we do the next story?
The fact that this is Jim. While I was in the home office, I had the distinct pleasure to work with Captain Eddie. If he needed some help, whatever, he would call on me. I thought that was fantastic.
Oh, by the way, Jim Hart, we do have Jim Graybill with us tonight, also one of our hosts. And, Jim, any comments about the Wright Cyclone or Johnny I want to say Johnny Ray. I keep thinking of Johnny Ray, the singer. But at any rate, good that you're with us tonight, Jim.
Jim Graybill.
Well, I thought he was with us. Okay.
Might have lost him.
Yeah, we must have lost him off the board here. Jim, go ahead.
The thing that I remembered very much was when Captain Eddie would call us all together in the home office.
Just a little ahead of what's being said there.
We used to have a Monday morning gathering on what happened, you know, in the past weekend. And this was a fantastic thing where Captain Eddie would say, "Hey, listen, let's get that thing together. Let's do what we have to do. Let's help the passengers." Unbelievable.
Must have been great sitting in in a meeting with Captain Eddie.
And that was at the same time that Floyd Hall came in.
My golly. Well, Jim, you were going to ask me about the next story that we have out of the archives of the Retired Eastern Airline Pilots Association.
Yeah.
And this story appeared in the 1985 issue of Repartee, And it was written by Captain John Sheridan. And the title is The Pilot. The Pilot. And it goes like this. He was a pilot without a plane, a captain without a uniform. He was a man older than his years, his face weathered by two wars and a near-fatal crash. But his smile was generous, and his eyes were bright and unthreatening. What he had not experienced, he had seen. Yet to him, there was little difference between the two. The boy took every delight in accompanying his father to LaGuardia Airport. He would relish the company of the other pilots, listen to their talk on navigation and techniques of flying, and when he could steal away, he would charge into the nearest DC-3. They all knew him, the mechanics, the ramp agents, and they knew he wouldn't touch anything. He would, of course, as any boy would do. But touching to him meant feeling, caressing the mechanics of flight that was his father's life. Behind the door that separated the main cabin from the cockpit was the boy's world. A world that mesmerized his senses with a delicate aroma of gasoline and leather. A world filled with switches, levers, and instruments. And when he sat in the left seat, he would envision bringing to life the two right engines, thirsting to be awakened, taxing the great ship to the end of the runway for a mag check. LaGuardia Tower, Eastern 156, ready to roll. Then take off, easing the throttles forward, feeling the wheels grumble heavily on the uneven strip. Rotate, gear up, flaps up, and he would climb to the freedom of the sky. A perfect takeoff, he thought. His father would be proud of him. Then his reverie would be shattered, as it always was, by a voice from the port side of the great ship. Always the port side, because he was the captain. The left side was his domain. Hey, kid, your dad's looking for you. He's up in dispatch. Sadly, the boy switched off the ignition to his whirl, secured the cockpit until the next flight, and he left, unaware that something else was going to happen, a memory he could recall at any moment from the flight deck of his mind for as many years as he was allotted. He found his father in dispatch, and hand in hand with the man he admired, started to walk down the long flight of stairs that led to the main entrance of the building. About a third of the way down, the boy noticed a figure standing in the foyer below, contemplating the long climb up. There was a sadness to him, the boy felt. Yet something about the man was familiar. The man wore his hat squarely on his head. The deliberate and agonizing steps he took as he started to climb the stairs, his hands gripping the railing firmly. When finally they met in the middle, the boy realized who the man was. "Good morning, Captain," said the boy's father. "Morning, George." Then the father introduced the boy to the man. Nervously, he stuck out his hand. "Good morning, sir." "Well," said the man, taking the boy's hand and placing the other on his narrow shoulder, "you going to be a pilot like your dad?" The boy gleamed. "Yes, sir." The man nodded his approval with grim resolve. "Good, very good. Come and see me when you're ready." Then the man ruffled the boy's hair, turned, and continued walking up the long flight of stairs. At the bottom, the boy looked back at the man and waved goodbye. The man waved back. "Wow, Papa," the boy said to his father, his eyes flaring with excitement. "Do you know who that was?" "Well, the boss was Captain Edward V. Rickenbacker." The father was Captain George M. Sheridan, and the boy was me, John Sheridan.
Thanks, Neil. Wow. Do any of our other hosts have any comments that about Neil's experience and his article?
Well, that was a fabulous, fabulous story. I love that, and it's very touching. Yeah, that was great, Neil.
Well, thank you.
I tell you.
That was the generosity of the man himself, Eddie Rickenbacker, because he was a very generous man. Although people like Jim Hart may have trembled in his presence, right, Jim?
Yes, I did, Neil. You cannot believe this man was about three size the size of my hand, and his ears, I could not believe it. His ears were bigger than President Obama.
Oh, come on now. Come on.
Really, really.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I don't remember George. Go ahead. I'm sorry, George.
Yeah, that's because your ears are the one part of your body that continually grows when the rest of it stops growing. That's why a lot of times you see older people with really big ears.
Oh, is that why they're calling me Jumbo or whatever the elephant is?
Jumbo. Wait, Jumbo.
But you have to realize the ears grow bigger because your hearing goes bad.
I thought it was because your head shrinks, but I was wrong.
No.
Well, question. Does anyone remember George Sheridan? I don't remember him. Must have been a long time ago. And John Sheridan, his son, who wrote that article and sent it in for publishing. That was during Bill Malone's time when he was the editor of Repartee. And we'll talk more about Bill's stories, because a lot of the stories appearing in the Repartee and the archives that I draw most of these stories, a lot of these stories, as a matter of fact, all of them tonight. But there's some great, great history of Eastern Airlines in that in those magazines of 35-plus years. Jim?
Yep. You know, in our further discussion, Steve, what do you have from those significant men in their flying machines? What are your remembrances?
Well, Jim, and radio listeners, this is a story about one of Eastern's earliest hijackings. And it's written by Hank Foley, entitled Jogging My Memory. He begins by saying, I had to look back in the old logbook to jog my memory about some of the dates, and that helped me relive some pleasurable trips. I'd been qualified and flying as first officer on the 720 for some time, but like the old story, not enough seniority to hold a good trip. Late in 1963, I qualified and held a reserve spot on the Braniff 707 interchange, then started bouncing back and forth between the 720 and 727 for the next 2 years, flying the interchange with Slim Babbitt, Mel Thayer, Andy McDonough, Jim Williams, Jim Rush, Chuck Rogers, and Dave Schreiner, just to name a few of the most talented pilots and gentlemen you would want to work with. This was during the time of the seat swapping, and the regular first officer bid holders were Marty Bennett, Jack Bedall, Dick Neubauer. Bob Anderson never complained openly about the junior getting some stick time. 1965 and 66 and 67, I gradually got more seniority and was glad to see those last four names transferred to the captain list. Now I could hold top first officer bid on the 707 and proceeded to bid Slim Babbitt's sequence. Each month, we'd decide which line we wanted for the next month. My logbook shows that month after month of memorable trips with Slim. In mid-1968, the Braniff interchange was terminated, so we went to the next best trip, 720 trip, was Miami-San Juan. No weather and no New York ATC, and the pay wasn't bad either. On September 20th, 1968, trip 950, about halfway from San Juan to Miami, non-English-speaking Cuban, forced open the cockpit door with the revolver in hand, shouting, "Cuba, Cuba, Cuba." We were all stunned for a moment, and Slim said, "What the hell does he want?" I said, "Well, he wants to go to Cuba, and looks like he means business." John Berg was the second officer, and I saw his face go white when he saw the gun with the hammer back, and I couldn't blame him a bit. There was a couple of other minor incidents, but to shorten the story, we went to Havana and met three MiGs over the airport that indicated we should land, which we did. The thing that seemed to tee the Cubans off most was the fact that we approached their coast, flew all the way up the coast to Havana, over military installations, labor camps, and farmland without even being detected on their radar. In our news interviews after the return, the government didn't want the radar unawareness publicized. They also didn't want it made public that there was a shot fired in the cockpit. Slim's only comment later was the hijacker tried to part his hair. We learned later, too, that one of the passengers, Joe Mars, an aircraft parts supplier from North Miami, was on board and got some good pictures of the three MiGs. Another thing that didn't get in the papers was that we were not able to use radios, but we did push the new hijack transponder code several times that had just been published the day before, but apparently ATC did not put their manuals up to date because they never recognized it. Now, the story couldn't be complete if I didn't give proper credit to the flight attendants on the trip who took care of the needs and welfare of the passengers. They did a great job. A week later, Slim and I were back in San Juan bed regularly through 68 and 69 until he retired, and I was promoted to captain on the 727. I retired in 1981.
What a great story, Steve. Any thoughts from any of our other hosts? Well, I have one here from 1985, Repartee, and this is titled Uninvited Comments by Tom Bartley. You know, one night in 1987, whoops, is that right? 1987,
yeah.
I flew to San Antonio as a pass rider on an Eastern 727. The landing was one of those that you might say, hey, it didn't look any more like I think they were on the ground. It was like a grease job. On the way out, I paused at the cockpit door to make a ritual comment to the pilot. Somebody had to paint brush pout, I said in a curt manner, which did not invite further conversation. I couldn't really fault him too much. I was aware, of course, that pilots do not take kindly to uninvited comments on their performance from unqualified commentators. But I had not expected that this young captain would take me from just another old duffer who pretended to have some knowledge of flying and wanted to be horned in on his act. And it was a timely reminder to me that after 20 years of retirement, I was no longer a recognizable member of the team. When I was an active pilot, I was just a spring-loaded against unsolicited comments from unqualified experts. As anyone else, I remembered very well a certain young co-pilot many years ago. Very, very new and very, very green at the time, who had a bad habit of telling me what a fine job I had done almost every time I put a DC-3 on the ground, right side up and rolling. I had to try to figure out a painless way to inform this young man that this was not required to critique the captain's landings. I can just see myself telling him, Thomas Berry, Dawson, or Chivalry, Charles, what a good landing that you had just made. Of course, a kudo from a person of established status with the proper credentials would have been more different matter. I still remember with pleasure an occasion when my friend Captain Jim Crawford flew with me from Atlanta to JFK on the jump seat of a DC-8. And he made a few kind remarks and comments after we had landed. Nothing could have pleased me more. Some years before that, after I had finished a check ride with Captain Jack Wayman in an L-1049, he made a favorable comment in a quiet, low-keyed manner. You can bet your next month's retirement pay that I did not object. Established old pros like Jim Crawford with Jim Wayman were eligible to critique my performance at any time. Of all unwelcome comments from unqualified observers, the most obnoxious, I think, well, are those from passengers who are otherwise an entire flight in terms of how smooth the landing was. Some years ago, my wife and I flew into Dallas on an American Airlines 727, and we landed in a rough, gusty wind. The airplane was bouncing all over the, almost like a cork. The pilot did a first-rate job. He thought it was fast and bouncing. It was blast. It was unbelievable. It was crabbing into the wind smoothly, rubbered, and on the crab. And would you believe
he? Where is he? Where is
it was pushed to the wheels to the runway. Any knowledgeable pilot would have called it an excellent landing. However, it wasn't a greased landing. It never was supposed to be.
We got another.
It was unless it may be an old horseshoe that just happened to be working over daily. Even so, a pair of noisy passengers just happened to be there working overtime. I think there were grease jobs. Even so, it was unbelievable. I told you about the pair of noise. Even so, about a rough landing. Who made a rough landing? I said to my wife, and they're speaking loudly to being sure. About a rough landing. I can't believe this. The guy is a real pro. He sure knows how to point, put one down in a rough off crosswind. It's my entire flight career. The time when I had the most experience with non-pilots who evaluated my flying time was in the winter of 1944-1945 when I was with the Allied Airborne England Army in England, and the frequency that had shuttled back and forth to the Allied from our advanced headquarters and in France. I could not believe this. I often had to shuttle back and forth between the officers and me, and they never failed to inform me that I had done a fine job. I thought that was great. I will cite just one more example of when I was in France preparing to fly back to England from Villers-Cambrai, an airport in Paris. The reported came when I was in definite zero, but the visibility was more than adequate for a safe takeoff. The ceiling at that point was about 2,000 feet. A group of about a dozen airborne officers who had been wondering whether in for a few days I wanted to hitch a ride with me, maybe, to go back to England. And I gathered them in a brief rundown and on the weather and explained that it should be a routine flight. You know, we took off, we climbed out on top, and I turned a nav receiver to the frequency of an ADF homing station on the north coast of France, which was the first intended checkpoint. Nothing happened. Not a wiggle out of the ADF and not a chirp out of the audio. I flew along for a while on the flight plan heading. Then I turned to the frequency on my second intended checkpoint. Oh, wow. Which was point an ADFA station on the south shore of England. It was just as dead as the first one off the air. Kaput. I just couldn't believe that this was not too well. Sailing along on top of a solid overcast, along with no way to check my position or determine my drift, if any, I didn't know until later, just a bit later, that we had strong crosswinds out of the west, which blew us way off course, and I continued on the flight plan heading of a suitable length of time, as just estimated. Then I turned into the flight plan, heading for a subtropical length of time, estimated again, and then, wow. Then I turned on to what I thought was a strong flight plan and a frequency of the Greenham commable range station, which was my final intended rate aid. And then I thought, wow. I thought, how can I use this for my descent and landing? The signal came in intended from my radio and my radio aid, and then I thought, wow, for a decent landing, what can I do? The signal came in again, clear. Then again, it was weak. I was receiving an on course that figured, but that time we ought to clear the intended intersection. And I can't believe it was receiving an on-course signal. Well, I couldn't believe this. And then, unbelievable, I soon had a good volume and built up. And then everything seemed to be going very well. It was unbelievable. I can't believe that. Humanity, Dory. And so I thought I continued west, flying on course, and the volume continued to build up and up and up and up. But it was taking much too long to reach Greenham. Of course, I knew by then that we had a a very strong wind out of the west. But I had no idea how far we had been thrown off course until a break appeared in the cloud. And then below, I had looked and known and identified Windsor Castle. Windsor Castle. Well, fantastic. So anyway, I could not believe this. And then Windsor Castle, of course, I knew by then that we had a strong wind out of the west. But then I had no idea how far we had been thrown off course until a break in the clouds appeared. And then I had, again, no idea how far I was gone, but my hair just about stood on end if I was still that far off west of Greenwich Common. Then I had certainly been east of London and maybe even out over the North Sea. But when I first intercepted the east leg of the GSE range, eventually I couldn't believe this. I had eventually had a real problem and intercepted the eastern leg of the GC Lane, but also over the middle of London, I was open season 24 hours a day on any aircraft that wanted to try to shoot me down over the middle of London, aerospace. Don't think I didn't squirm. Now, that is how I knew that my exact position, for the first time since I even reacted, landing gear on the airplane, I was going to go ahead and land it off, okay? Well, wait a minute. That was my exact position. But from Paris, I reduced power in a bit, and then I made a recruiting descent. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And then the overcast with the airport dead ahead after we had landed, my airborne friends, all of them gathered around me and said, "Aren't you damn good? You did a good job." Well, thank you. I read. Thank you very much. Thank you. I liked it very much. And you all, you will bet that your bottom dollar that all I said was when we didn't know where we would come in, that we did come in. And here we are.
Jim. Hey, Jim, can I compliment you for the extra, I don't know, humor that Tom Bartley was not known for?
Neil, let me tell you, my glasses are fogging up here in the cellar, and I'm having a problem reading.
Jim Bartley, he passed away several years ago, but I can imagine that he was smiling and laughing through the whole the whole story. Can you do that again, Jim?
I guess I could if I keep my glasses fogged up.
I sure hope you got your SAG payments for being an actor on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York.
George, that song could only mean one story is about to be told. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm ready. From London to New York, New York, as written by Captain Bill Malone in the summer of 1987 issue of the Repartee. Now, he didn't write New York, New York for Frank Sinatra, but he wrote this story for Repartee. What a hell of a town. There's no place on earth quite like New York. It's been characterized as being both dirty and being lovely. It has the best and the worst. Some consider it cruel and uncompromising. It's a tough town and it is challenging. It's the center for style, advertising, business, commerce, art, music, architecture, and everything else one can think of. You have to be good to make it in New York, like Frank Sinatra said. You have to be ingenious just to survive if you live there. And believe me, I know that from experience. To many of us, it represents high adventure, and each visit is a never-to-be-forgotten experience. As a brand-new co-pilot, your editor was with Larry Hamilton as he approached LaGuardia Airport in a blizzard back in the mid-1940s. The marker beacon in the cockpit began its frantic beep. Blue and amber lights flashed. The artificial horizon indicated a steep bank, and we were on our way down. The glow of the lights on the Edison tank rushed by, and suddenly the wings were level and the runway lights were dead ahead. No carnival ride ever held such a thrill. The big balloon tires on the DC-3 touched the snow and slid down the center of the runway. It was clear that there was much to be learned flying the airline, and those of us who came to Eastern from the military after the war were about to be taught by experts in the field. Back in those days, we rode into town on the bus and subways. To a country boy, it was a mystic maze. We made several transfers, rode on an elevated train for a time, then rolled down through a long tunnel. We walked up some narrow steps and out into the most spectacular sight. We were in Duffy Square, Times Square. Mm-hmm. Huge snowflakes were floating down. There were millions of lights and tremendous buildings in every direction. There was a huge signboard with a picture of a man, and he was blowing smoke rings which hovered over Broadway. It was as though we were stepping up before the pearly gates. Any other city would have ceased to function with all that snow on the ground, but New York simply came alive, with everyone out walking, shopping, and enjoying themselves in a storybook environment. You have to be adroit to live in New York City, so those who reside in Manhattan are very independent and know how to use the resources available to them. Old people who long ago would have been relegated to the nursing home are out, walking around, boarding the city buses, walking the dog, and going to the theater. They've always been self-sufficient, so they continue to do what comes naturally. Because New York is so competitive, everyone is in a hurry. People ordinarily do not pause to, quote, pass the time of day, unquote. However, they are friendly and will assist you with directions as to which bus to take or how to make your way down to the Fulton Market. New York City was born in the first quarter of the 17th century at the southern tip of Manhattan Island. So it's been around India Company during the Netherlands' golden age of colonial and maritime expansion. It's a city of unique architecture. St. Paul's Chapel between Broadway and Church Street, built in 1764, still stands, as does the federal passageway to the backyard at 11 Van Dam Street with its original brick vaulted storage room with stone steps. It is still in use. It is a city of both the old and the new. The tallest building in the world between 1913 and 1930 and still standing was the Woolworth Building. It provided space for the Irving National Bank and headquarters for Woolworth, Five and Dime chain. It features lots of windows, more than 5,000, providing natural light. The World Trade Center, with its 110-story twin towers adjacent to the Woolworth Building, had dramatic appeal with its staggering height. They created spectacular silhouettes and relationships to their surroundings in stark contrast to the skyscrapers of yesteryear. There's so much to be seen in Manhattan. You walk a lot and welcome the opportunity to visit a restaurant and sit down. New York has the best from all over the world. One enters Markey's from a tree-lined avenue, down some steps into a flower-filled patio. Ivy grows up along the brick wall. It was once a fashionable home. Waiters are attired in tuxedos. There's no menu because the meals consist of five courses, each a connoisseur's delight. The fare is Italian, but a far cry from the heavy concoctions usually thought of as typically Italian. Here, the lasagna was light and delicate and brought back memories of Rome and Florence. The entire evening must be set aside, to enjoy Markey's. Dining's an art in Gotham, and no one is more proficient than a New Yorker to whom it is a reward, a celebration for a day's hard work and accomplishment. One meal a day, supplemented by a modest snack, is ample. For lunch, one must afford himself or herself the experience of dining at Sweets, downtown at the Fulton Fish Market. Access is by way of some stairs to the second floor, containing a series of rooms with wide oak floors, white linen tablecloths and napkins, and the aroma of the bounty of the sea. The fashionable crowd from Wall Street can be found here also. Such dining pleasure will leave time to walk around the waterfront and see the sailing vessels from yesteryear, along with the old Ambrose lightship we used to fly over when approaching what was then known as Idlewild. The most difficult thing to do is to set aside some time for rest, for there's so much to see and do in Manhattan, and one hates to miss out. But this is an absolute necessity prior to attending the theater. To see a play in New York is to enjoy an emotional experience that you'll never forget. Some of the dramas use sparse scenery, but the actors and actresses paint the picture in your mind with their performance. The musicals are extravaganzas that will make you pat your foot to the music. You'll remember what you see and hear for the rest of your life. No place in the world can equal it. No place is like New York. It has always been like that. What better place to celebrate the 36th wedding anniversary, as did your editor and his better half?
Oh, fantastic. How
Very
great
good.
A description of New
yeah.
York, as told by Captain Malone. How about any discussion from our host?
Oh, yes. Bill Malone and his bride, or I should say Jan Malone, and he always talked about her as his bride. They had a wonderful anniversary, and only the description that George just read that Bill Malone wrote in Repartee could describe the feelings of this man. I've heard, and as a matter of fact, I had the pleasure of interviewing Bill Malone because he was REPA's Hall of Fame one year, and he made it into Hall of Fame, and I had the pleasure of interviewing Bill. I was the editor of Repartee for about 5 years, and oh, how he talked about the love of his life, Joy Malone. And as a matter of fact, I'll never forget an expression that he used when he first met Joy, when he got off the elevator at the Coke operations. He saw this lovely lady, and he he wanted to say something that might impress her, that he might be considered, you know, someone that she might want to date. But the first words that he spoke, I'll never forget when he told me, was, "What do you do for amazement?" What do you do for amazement? And that was Bill Malone. And a lot of us had the pleasure of flying with Bill. But oh, how he could describe events and places like New York and even trains that he wrote about. And I often talk with Jan about publishing some of Bill's stories that are in Repartee. Jim?
That's fantastic. Thank you very much, Neil. Our last story in this collection is from another Eastern pilot and told tonight by Margaret Bars, our former flight attendant, our senior flight attendant. Margaret.
Thanks, Jim. Wow, such great stories from Eastern's past, and what prolific writers all. Now, this story comes from the 1999 fall-winter issue of Repartee. Its author is Captain O.A. Fish, as printed in the Reader's Digest.
Honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God.
On the Eastern Airlines Boston-Miami flight that I captain, we normally follow the East Coast to Wilmington, North Carolina, then go down Atlantic Route 1, a shortcut to Miami over water. But on the morning of last January 28th, that route would have taken us 60 miles east of Cape Canaveral and into the flight pattern of the Space Shuttle Challenger. So when I took my place at the controls of our Boeing 757, I was not surprised that we had been rerouted down the coastline. We had 135 passengers and were ready to go, but the delay in launching Challenger was delaying us too. On the intercom, I kept the passengers informed as to the reasons for the holdup. I expected some irritation, but for once everyone seemed to understand. They were especially interested in this launching because it was to carry the first ordinary American into space, school teacher Christer McAuley. At last we took off, and for a while the flight was uneventful. Just south of Wilmington, however, I heard another pilot on a radio frequency ask, "Did the spacecraft take off yet?" A pause. Then came the air controller's answer, "Yes, but it blew up 1 minute into flight." Stunned silence on the frequency. Then another voice broke in, "Did you just say what I thought you said?" "Yes, I'm afraid so." My co-pilot, Barney Ross, and I sat staring into the open space ahead of us, not speaking at first. Then the words stumbled out. "No, it can't be. Not all those people." My thoughts turned to our passengers. How would the news affect them? Boston is a regional airport for the Northeast. There might be some friends or relatives of Christy McAuliffe's on the plane. I couldn't make an announcement like that cold over the PA system. But I had passengers back there who deserved to know. If I'd been home, I would have prayed with friends and fellow church members. There in my own community, we could have reached out to God for comfort and assurance. But this was a Boeing 757 filled with people I'd never seen before. Should I tell them or wait until we landed? Barney and Mary Pipe, the senior flight attendant, thought I should wait. While I was still trying to decide, I was handed a note from a passenger. He was writing a letter to Eastern Management complimenting our crew on the flight. He said he particularly liked the way I had kept passengers informed about the shuttle and the reasons for delay. Barney tapped me on the shoulder. I looked up from the note, my eyes following his gaze out the cockpit window. There was a large, white vapor cloud standing starkly alone. "Is there a minister on board?" I asked Mary Pipe. She checked the passenger list. "Yes, the Reverend J.D. Gauthier, a Jesuit priest, was seated near the rear." "Call him aside," I told her. tell him the news, and ask if he'd be willing to provide spiritual assistance. Pipe came back and said the priest had agreed. I glanced one more out the window as the ominous cloud drew nearer. Please, I said, ask him to lead us in a prayer after I make the announcement. I switched on the microphone. Ladies and gentlemen, I have some very distressing news, I began. I'm sorry to have to tell you, but the spaceship Challenger has been destroyed. It exploded just after takeoff. We were over Daytona Beach. As I banked the plane, the huge cloud floated into the passenger's view. Father Gauthier began reading the 23rd Psalm over the PA system. The Lord is my shepherd. There is nothing I shall want. Fresh and green are the pastures where he gives me repose. Near restful waters he leads me. By now we were passing over Cape Canaveral. To revive my drooping spirit, he guides me along the right paths. He's true to his name. If I should walk in the valley of darkness. The shadow of the cloud had fallen across the plain, blocking the sun. No evil would I fear. You are there with your crook and your staff. With these you give me comfort. You have prepared a banquet for me in the sight of my foes. My head you have anointed with oil. My cup is overflowing. As the cloud passed from sight, sunlight once again streamed through the windows. Surely goodness and kindness shall follow me all the days of my life. In the Lord's house shall I dwell forever and ever. Father Gauthier prayed for the astronauts, for their families. Even though I couldn't see the passengers, I knew that every head on our plane was bowed, every heart touched. After we landed in Miami, I left the cockpit to meet the man whose prayer had helped us all. Together, we watched the passengers disembark. No one seemed to hurry. People walked slowly, some still wiping their eyes, others reaching out to lift a heavy bag or help with a sleepy child. Young, old, men, women. I watched as this small sampling of mankind left the plane. Several people shook my hand. Others expressed their appreciation to Father Gauthier. It was almost as if we were leaving church after a touching service. I knew none of us would ever forget where we were that day in January when Challenger exploded. In still another time of national crisis, we'd found again how much we needed one another, how much we needed and depended upon God. And I knew we'd never feel closer to God than when we were part of that prayer meeting, 39,000 feet high, in the Florida sky. Captain O.A. Fish, best known by most Eastern pilots as O.A., is the author of a beautifully inspired book, Fingerprints of God. Since retirement, he's been a speaker, writer, and a talk show host for radio and TV. He and his wife, Charlotte, are founders of a Christian camp located in Bostic, North Carolina. For a free copy of the beautiful Challenger print, you may write him at South Mountain Christian Camp, P.O. Box 9, Bostic, that's spelled B-O-S-T-I-C, North Carolina, 28018. Or you may email him at smcc@blueridge.net. Donations greatly appreciated.
Margaret, I had a beautiful song that was written by John Denver about that tragic event in our country's history. And it just didn't appear for me to pipe in John Denver's song that he dedicated to those astronauts that were on that faithful Challenger flight. But I think all of us can remember where we were, what we were doing during that time or at that event. I, for one, was on a trip. And my layover was in Los Angeles. And I was out at the, I can't remember exactly, but it was over at the Marina del Rey. And they had a little village over there. I think it was Fisherman's Village or something like that. And I was having fish and chips for lunch or whatever. And I was kind of outside looking through the window of this restaurant. And I saw the President of the United States come on, and it was Ronald Reagan. and he was talking about that tragic event and how powerful his speech was or his remarks were during that time. And but John Denver did a wonderful job of recording. I think it was Fly For Me or something like that. I forgot the exact title. But any thoughts from our other host of where they were and what their thoughts were at the time?
Oops. Written in account of that flight, and that was great. And Margaret, you did a great job with it.
I'm sorry, Steve. I didn't catch your first remarks. I had the mic off because I thought I was playing John Denver's song, but as it turned out, I didn't have that in the file there. But would you please repeat your remarks?
Yeah, I was friends with O.A. Fish, and I knew him well, and that is a great account of that event. And, Margaret, you did a great job with it.
Oh, thank you very much, Steve.
We've had O.A. Fish on our program early in the history of the Eastern Airlines radio show. As a matter of fact, we invited him to come on, and we talked a little bit about the beautiful portrait that he commissioned. As a matter of fact, it is behind me on the wall right now that he sent me a copy of. And it also is sold, I think, at the Smithsonian, I believe, and it also sold down at the Cape Canaveral at their museum there, and also, I think, over in the Pensacola area at the Naval Museum. But it's a beautiful rendition, and I forgot the name of the artist, but O.A. Fish asked this person to do a rendering of what he felt at the time flying over and the events that Margaret read. And this picture is just a beautiful picture. It has the beautiful 757 flying over the central part of Florida, and in the clouds, the astronauts that were on that Challenger mission. A beautiful rendering. And Margaret, would you give again the address and how to contact O.A. Fish? Because he's doing a worthy cause up in the North Carolina area with his mission for young people. And I can appreciate the fact that he would really appreciate any donations that people could send his way. Would you repeat that?
I'd be more than happy to do that, Neil. You may contact Captain O.A. Fish at South Mountain Christian Camp, P.O. Box 9, Bostic, North Carolina, and that's spelled B-O-S-T-I-C, and the zip is 28018. You may also email him at smcc@blueridge.net. And again, as Neil said, donations are greatly appreciated. And just to comment, as I was reading the story, I was looking at the print that Neil has behind him. And I have to say, it was very difficult reading that, looking at those faces, looking back at me. It was such a sad event.
Yeah. And by the way, folks, that was written up in the Reader's Digest magazine that Margaret first led into the story. And a wonderful story that was written by O.A. Fish, the captain on that flight that experienced that fateful day.
Well, Eastern family, that's our show about this evening. And the show is about an awful lot of different things. Please tell your friends and anyone you know that remember Eastern Airlines. Tell them about our show, the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Remember, you can listen to us anytime around the clock by going to our archives of our previous 119 broadcasts. You'll be surprised at what you can hear there. Just type in on your computer www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie, CAPTEDDIE. This is something we really hope to hear from you again and look forward to our next radio broadcast. Please be with us. Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night.